Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from Worm Farm Institute with the Farm Art Detour, a self-guided excursion through 50 miles of scenic farmland in rural Sauk County, October 5th through the 14th. WormFarmInstitute.org.
A little Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I believe, there with Our House to get us going as we talk about your house and maybe my house as well on the real estate market with our old friend Kevin Trost, been with us many times, founding attorney of Trost LLC, has over 20 years of experience representing individuals. He represents financial institutions, businesses, and insurers basically throughout the state and federal court systems. He has extensive experience handling disputes arising from, from residential real estate transactions. And so we're talking about buying or selling a home and wondering what questions you might have, maybe about the market, or maybe you're wondering about the legal process of buying or selling. Want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Kevin Trost, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's great to be back with you.
So let's look at the home prices over the last, say, 5 years. Give us a little bit of an overall of how we got here, where we are.
Certainly. Now, I think about 5 or maybe a little bit more years ago, we started seeing a dramatic rise in the prices of homes.
Yeah.
And that's generally continued, although I think we've seen kind of a plateauing over the last year or couple years, especially as the, you know, the interest rates have
gone up
over time. And so I think currently we're kind of at a plateau area where in Wisconsin as a state, you're looking at an average home price in the $320,000 area. Now that's going to vary depending upon what area of the state you're in. Some areas might be higher, some areas might be lower, but just in general,
that's the median price.
Right.
And what about inventory levels across the state, do you know?
And Indian forward levels continue to be on the tight side. And I think a lot of that is tied to not only kind of lack of new construction, but also the fact that people who are in their home currently that might be on the verge of deciding that they want to move out of their house are kind of having second thoughts of doing that because they look at the interest rates.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people had refinanced a few years ago when they could get an interest rate of 3% or 4%. And they realize, if I'm going to sell my house, I'm going to have to move somewhere and therefore have a new mortgage. And they look at what the current mortgage rates are and they say, well, I think I'll hold off and I'll stay where I am right now. So you see, in the end, you see not as much of the existing home inventory coming onto the market.
Which may keep the price up a bit.
I think it does.
For the homes that are for sale. And the Federal Reserve, of course, earlier this month, I think it was, lowered the rates. What they consider when they decided to lower the rates?
I think, well, the Federal Reserve, you know, being a national, looking at everything nationally, they are looking at obviously more than just the real estate market. They're looking at interest rates in general and the fluctuations in the economy and a more, you know, macro type of view. With regard to real estate, I think what you're going to see is the interest rates that are offered for mortgages will continue to back off as the Federal Reserve's interest rate comes down. And even without the Federal Reserve lowering interest rates, you've seen that over the last year. About a year ago, you'd see interest rates typically over 7%, even the mid-7 percentile percentage. And now, just on its own, even before the Federal Reserve took action, you can get a mortgage that the interest rate is in the low 6s.
And that makes a big difference, but it's still not three. And you think it'll ever be that low again?
Hard to say. Hard to say what's going to happen in the future. Because 20, 30 years ago, if you told somebody that at one point in the future, you're going to see interest rates of 3%, they would have thought you're crazy. So never say never, but I don't think anybody's really predicting that the interest rate on mortgages is going to go down to 4% anytime in the near term or even the midterm.
Okay, and so around 6, let's say, what do you think it's going to mean for the housing market? There's still people, you know, as you were talking about, there's still people that, well, I got to borrow. If I sell, then I got to borrow.
That's true. And it'll continue to be something that keeps people who are in existing homes from deciding to sell their homes. But the lower the interest rate goes, I think the more people there will be that will be willing to take a chance, but decide to go for it and sell their house. You know, so if you get the interest rate down to 5%, more people might say, hey, I'll put my house on the market.
Yeah, and I mean, we've got an older population. I mean, basically, there are a lot of people that are going to have to be moving.
At some point in time, yes.
One way or another, they're going to have to be moving. And so maybe that'll make a difference. In your opinion, so do you think the prices are going to stay pretty high on homes?
I think at least for the near-term future, it looks like the prices are here to stay at their current levels. We'll see what happens, but
yeah,
at least it's plateaued. You know, we're not seeing the huge increase in prices that you saw a few years ago.
So you focus on a lot on residential real estate transactions. What kinds of legal frameworks exist around the real estate market?
Sure. A lot of my legal practice focuses on home sales gone awry, which largely involves people who have purchased a house or have sold a house, and then there are a change in expectations. People who expect going into a house that they bought something and they knew what the maybe some of the imperfections of the house were, and then they discover something completely different within a month or so of moving into the house, and they start to wonder, well, did the people who sold me this house know about this problem and fail to disclose it? And so a lot of this focus goes back to the Real Estate Condition Report, which is a report set out in Wisconsin law that residential sellers of real estate have to complete when they're selling their house. And it's a list of, it varies over time because they change the questions, but it's a series of questions, usually about 50 or 60, asking people, are you aware of defects in X? Such as, are you aware of defects with the roof? Are you aware of defects in the plumbing? Are you aware of water intrusion problems or foundation problems? And the folks who are selling the house have to go through and check yes or check no, or there's also a box, NA, if it's a question that really isn't applicable to the house.
So when you're selling a house, you need to be pretty upfront about what you do know.
It helps a lot. It's very important to be truthful and upfront about what you know about the house that you're living in that you're trying to sell. And that just being upfront oftentimes will save you on the back end if the people that are buying the house later learn of something wrong with the house. It can save you from legal problems down the road.
Does it pay to, there's probably two ways to look at this, is what you know, but if you want to sell a house, getting a registered home inspector in before you sell the house to, you know, do the inspection?
There are people that do that. And then they have the home inspection report sitting there on the table when people come through to view the house. I think that's a great idea for people to do.
Somebody else said, well, then, then we have to tell everything. And I said, well, you have to tell everything anyway. But he said, but not if I didn't know it to begin with.
And that's true. That's one of the caveats on the real estate condition report. You have to disclose what the defects that you're aware of. If it's a problem you aren't aware of, there's no way you can possibly disclose that.
Yeah. But if the home inspector finds a problem that you're not aware of, you have to you report that. But it also then may save somebody calling you and saying, this person did not tell me about this thing.
That's absolutely true. And that happens every once in a while.
What are the most common undisclosed defects?
The most common ones involve water.
No.
Whether it's water in the basement from a foundation crack or maybe an improper grade that causes water to flow through the backyard and go into the basement over the foundation wall, or water through the roof because there's a leaky roof. But generally, it involves water.
Not a good thing. And water, you do not want to be sitting in your living room and during a rainstorm and water is hitting you on the head.
Absolutely true. Definitely want to avoid that situation.
That builder really would sell set a buyer off.
That is true. Builders go through lots of efforts when they're building the house to put protections in place so that water does not get on the inside of the house.
Kevin Trost, our guest today, founding attorney of Trost LLC, works out of Madison, have lots of experience handling disputes arising from residential real estate transactions. What's your experience been with buying or selling a home? What questions do you have for Kevin? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at buying and or selling a home on the show today with Kevin Trost, and it's great to have him back with us. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in with a call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. And just to let you know, at noon today, professional home stagers make sure your house is stable and ready to hit the market. We get tips for getting your home ready to sell at noon today on the program. So it's great to have that as well. Somebody wonders, what happens if you fail to report a defect in your home, but only because you didn't know about it?
Well, that's the thing. With the real estate condition report, it only asks you to report defects that you're aware of. And so if it's a defect that you're truly not aware of, then you're answering truthfully when you're checking that no box on the real estate condition report that asks you, are you aware of a defect in X?
Yeah. Kerry in central Wisconsin will go to you. Hi, Kerry.
Hi. My daughter and son-in-law bought their first home about 3 years ago and decided, because they had a home office in their basement, to test for radon, and it came up extremely high. It was a home that was built, it was probably like 20 years old when they bought it. Just wondering how that is to be reported. Is that something that it's in an area where there are a lot of homes with radon, and so they needed to remediate that. Just wondering how that gets handled after the sale of a home.
Well, the situation with a radon system, and it's fairly easy to mitigate. There's a pipe that gets put into the basement off in the sump pump area that takes the air and takes it outside the house, either a passive system or an active system that has a fan to help suck the air into it. in terms of whether that's something that should have been disclosed during the course of the sale, it really depends. It depends on if the people that your relatives bought the house from, whether they knew there was high radon or not. There's no requirement that a house be tested for radon as a part of a house sale or even a home inspection. Usually that's an add-on feature that the home inspector might offer for an additional fee. So there's no requirement that this home had ever been tested for radon in the past. But if it had and the folks that were selling the house knew that there was a high radon level, I would think that at some point that should have been disclosed in the course of the sale. But once again, it depends on if the people actually knew that problem.
Yeah, if they hadn't tested and didn't know the problem. Although I will say, I mean, we're a radon state. I mean, there's so many parts of the state that have high radon levels.
That is true. That is true. It's a good practice to just, as a standard practice, to test the home for radon.
Yeah.
And Larry, just before we go further, just so everybody knows, you know, we're not offering legal advice here today.
Yeah.
It's often not possible to
absolutely
legal and give people excellent legal advice over the phone based on just what's said during a call-in portion of a radio show. However, it is, you know, I'm offering the thoughts of a lawyer on the subjects. But I just wanted to make that nice legal lawyer disclaimer.
Okay. Kerry, there you go. Thank you. Scott in Windsor, we'll go to you. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My wife and I bought a home in Windsor back in 1996. And on the property condition report, it said mild seepage in basement. And I thought, well, okay, that's usual. The first time we had a heavy rain, it was flooded. The basement was just completely deluged. And we fixed the grade, and that solved the problem. But I've always been a bit haunted to know, what should I have done? And what recourse do you have when you find out that there's something that is qualitatively wrong on the condition report? What do you do?
Well, sure. And I think by the tone of your question, I think you understand that at this point in time, your legal remedies are
gone
long past since this was a sale back in 1996. But if this was a sale, you know, today, if somebody puts on the real estate condition report that there's mild, you know, water that comes into the basement with some rains, that's really kind of alerts the potential purchaser that there might be an issue. Because especially when you use terms such as mild, one person's mild water intrusion is another person's torrential flood. And so when you see language like that on a real estate condition report, a good practice is to check that out as much as you can. Also, ask for further clarification.
Yeah. What do you mean by mild?
Absolutely.
And the home inspector might look at the basement condition and maybe look at if there are water lines a foot high along the basement wall.
Right. And that's something definitely to look for. Not only, you know, a home inspector, but also yourself when you're touring the basement. Just look for signs that there was significant water intrusion or water problems in the past, whether it's moisture stains or, you know, if portion of the basement is finished, if there's some evidence that the lower portion of the drywall looks like it had been water damaged at some point in the past.
Yeah. And so in Scott's case, maybe he could have asked at the time, what do you mean by mild? And
I think that would be a good practice.
Yeah. All right. Scott, there you go. Thank you. Diane in Darlington, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I have two questions. One of them is using a lawyer adequate to handle all the legal issues in a closing with a sale for sale by owner?
Oh, a FSBO.
Yeah.
A lot of people do. Some people will go through a FSBO sale and handle everything themselves. Other people are more comfortable having a lawyer review the documents, sometimes prepare either the offer to purchase or, you know, a counteroffer or any amendments to the offer that may come up. And, you know, just from what I've seen in my practice, it can be very useful and helpful to avoid problems down the road. After all, a lot of times a real estate transaction, buying or selling a home, can be the biggest sale or biggest purchase that one goes through in life. And so it, a lot of times it can make sense to spend the extra money to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed on those transactions.
Yeah, I think that makes good sense. Diane, thank you for calling. James in Manawa, we'll go to you now. Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
When I first purchased my house 6 years ago, first week there, bathroom upstairs, all the drains were all clogged up. And then I'm a very handy person. I had to go and tear everything apart, fix it all up, come to find out that the drains were plugged all the way downstairs, outside, underneath the ground, and three-quarters of the way to the street. So I had to take care of all of that. I dealt with it. 2 years ago, it rained pretty decent, and come to find out that there's two windows in the basement that were covered over by a porch on the outside and drywall on the inside, but they never were filled with anything. There wasn't a window there. There wasn't plywood. There wasn't anything. It was just an open hole.
Wow.
Yeah. That's a strange situation.
That is indeed. And that's something that should have been, you would have thought, would have been in the condition report.
You would think so. If there was a place in the, if what I'm hearing right, if there's a place in the foundation or two places in the foundation where there should have been windows and there just weren't, and for some reason not anything that anybody could readily see without doing some extensive investigation.
Yeah. In that case, it's possible the person that owned the house before James didn't know it either.
That's quite possible. It's quite possible. A lot of times that depends on how long somebody owns a house. You know, if you're buying a house from somebody who lived there for 2 or 3 years, quite possible that they were completely baffled, as, you know, as unaware as you were for a number of years about this situation.
Wow, really? But if they lived there 30 years...
If they lived there 30 years, better chance that they would know it.
For sure.
Or if they were the ones that built the house.
Yeah, for sure. James, thank you for calling. There you go. Renee in Viroqua will go to you. Hi, Renee.
Good morning. Yes, I am wondering if I have a farm and I've negotiated a 5-acre sale, so it'd be going from a cropland to commercial. Is this something I can handle myself? Or should I get professional help?
So you're changing the zoning for the farm?
Well, I'm changing the zoning and I'm also selling that 5 acres off of a field.
Yeah.
Well, I think people are going to have different levels of comfort depending upon if they've done something like this before frequently in the past or not. I would say in that type of situation, you may want to consult an attorney unless this is something that you've regularly done in the past.
Yeah. Did you get the zoning changed already?
No, we haven't. But I did sell property in town, but then you've got everything listed and you just go to the title company and it was one unit together.
Yeah. Well, in your situation, you know, you kind of have a multi-step process there because you're going to have to change the zoning. And I found that a lot of people benefit from the help of a lawyer in getting the zoning changed, because there are times when your local municipality may not be as keen as you are on changing the zoning, especially if you're changing it, you know, from one type of zoning to another, such as to commercial.
Yeah, You may want to check with an attorney on this, because that's a big process. I'm just getting the zoning changed. You want to have somebody who really knows what they're doing on that, I would think.
That's true. I mean, yeah. Often towns and municipalities will have a, you know, have some type of plan for what they expect the land in their township to be, whether it's residential or agricultural or commercial, and they might not have any desire or plan for this area of land that you want to change to commercial to be actually commercial. So you might get some blowback on your request.
Yeah. Yes. There you go, Renee. Thank you for calling. Dennis in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Thing is, as far as mortgages, sometimes people need mortgages to settle estate problems, like when a property is available to all heirs. Somebody might need a mortgage to buy out the others, and I have a story if you wanted to hear how I handled it.
Well, it depends. Is it a short story, Dennis?
Oh, yeah, somewhat short. Okay, my siblings had animosity between them, and they both disowned my parents, and they accused me of being my parents' favorite when I was given the estate executor and the power of attorney. Well, I figure, well, they're probably going to think this house is worth so much, so I figure, hey, I just offer them this. They could split it halfway and each get $5,000, and I would get $20,000 and be out of it.
Hmm.
Because I figure, well, they're not going to want to battle between each other as far as who's going to get what and who's going to pay off the other. And so I figured, hey, they're just going to give it up.
Okay.
You see that happen oftentimes when there's multiple siblings and there's family dynamics going on where, you know, one person or two people don't like the other, or there's, you know, animosity between kids and parents. It leads to estate problems down the road when it's time to transfer property.
Well, and it makes very good sense then for the property owners to have a will that clearly states how the division of property is going to be made.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. And best to have that will professionally prepared to make sure that all the I's are dotted and all the T's are crossed, so that if the will gets submitted to probate court by, you know, one disenfranchised or angry relative, that the will hold up.
Yeah. Cheryl in Iron Ridge, thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, I just happen to be a real estate broker on my own in Wisconsin. I'm not with a big company, but I had a comment on the lady with the farm. Yeah. First of all, if she wants to sell the 5 acres, I would think she has two choices: to sell it the way it is and let the buyer determine how they want to change the zoning and let them go through the expense of changing the zoning or inquire about changing the zoning. And if she wanted to incur the cost of it, then she could do it ahead of time so she could sell it as a commercial piece of property. But it all comes down to one thing: money.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't want to spend the money to do it, then I would let the buyer spend the money to do it.
But then it's harder to probably find a buyer, I would think.
Necessarily not. If all she really has to do is call zoning and say, can this be done, and what is the procedure, she can offer that information to a prospective buyer, and the buyer can determine whether or not they want to do it. The perfect example is, can I turn my house into a duplex or not? Well, if it's a single-family residential lot, you can't turn it into a multifamily without going to zoning and doing it.
Yeah, yeah, All right. That makes sense, Kevin?
That makes total sense. It's going to, a lot of that is going to depend upon how amenable the local municipality, the local zoning board, is to making those changes.
And some zoning boards are pretty particular when it comes to ag land.
They can be.
Yeah, they can be very particular. So it all, and there's, how many would there be in this state of Wisconsin? Hundreds. Hundreds and hundreds.
Many, yes.
Yeah, let's put it that way. Yeah, Cheryl, thanks a lot. Appreciate your input. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Jerry emailed us, by the way, and says, again, on the news this morning was a story about someone whose home was sold out from underneath them. How and why is this possible, and what can you do to prevent it?
Well, I haven't seen that story.
I haven't either.
Yeah, I don't know completely what he's referencing, but maybe he's talking about situation where, I'm not sure if it's somebody a situation where they go and they record a different a deed with the Register of Deeds, and then based on that, having color of title, they try to sell the house. I think the Register of Deeds, from my experience, tends to be pretty attuned to watching out for those type of scams, at least around here.
Yeah, but that kind of makes sense. That may have been what happened in this case. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it. I mean, how is there any way to prevent it? Well, if you've got the deed.
If you have the deed and you're the record title holder, then, you know, at least you have, you know, colorable title in order to try and sell the property. And I think, but like I said, I think the Register of Deeds offices are pretty attuned to fly-specking things that come in to make sure that they're not just unwillingly participating in this type of scam.
Yeah.
I think most Register of Deeds offices are used to seeing new deeds come in from title agencies during the course of sales. And so if they get a deed that comes in just from somebody off the street that wants to record a deed, they'll give it a second look.
Yeah. Brad in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Brad.
Yeah, hi, Larry. I had a question. I have a family trust established. Everything's in it except for our home. Am I able to go through a title company to do that, to have that filed properly at the courthouse?
To have the trust filed or have something associated with your real estate filed?
The house, I think you meant.
To have the house put into the trust.
Oh, to have the...
Right now, it's in my spouse and my name at the current time. The trust has been set up for quite some time.
Well, I suspect a title agency would be willing to assist you. And if they weren't, they could probably direct you to probably a local real estate attorney who could assist with that. Probably a fairly simple process of deeding the property from people's individual names into the trust and then having that deed recorded.
I would think there may be some laws or some law relating to how long that process is, how many years or how many months or whatever that process needs to be in vogue or in practice, I guess I should say.
That's true. And I think speaking with somebody at a title agency or a local real estate attorney could probably give him the best way forward.
Brad, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kevin Trost, our guest today, founding attorney of Trost LLC, lots of experience handling disputes arising from residential real estate transactions. Questions? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at buying or selling a home today on the show with Kevin Trost of Trost LLC of Madison. It's great to have him by today to talk about buying your home, a home, or selling your home. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Mike in Fond du Lac has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I paid off our home in Fond du Lac after, gosh, a 30-year mortgage, I guess, in 2007. And, of course, there's been no further payments required. But I never did receive a title or deed from the mortgage lender. Should I go to a title search company or to the city some department of in Fond du Lac in order to get my title?
I think that's probably be the easiest way for you to do it. More than likely what happened when you made that final payment with your mortgage company is the mortgage company filed a satisfaction of mortgage against your property, which, you know, is the official record showing that this mortgage that they had previously recorded many decades earlier, showing that you owed them money, had now been satisfied and was no longer something that was affecting the title to your property. So, yeah, you point out two very simple, straightforward ways of getting the satisfaction of mortgage, or at least making sure it's there. One is to go to the Register of Deeds and do some searching yourself to find it in the record. The other way is to ask either a real estate lawyer or a title agency to request a letter report on the title for your house. And that'll give you a listing of everything that's been recorded against your property with the Register of Deeds. And that, my experience, that costs about $50.
Oh, so pretty cheap insurance there, Mike. Go and do. Thank you for calling. Bill in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. We have a second home lake cabin up in the North Woods that we intend to pass down to our kids. And we're getting two opinions on how to pass that property along, whether as a trust or through a cabin LLC, and wondered, based on what you've seen and experienced, which of those is a better route typically for people?
Well, I think either route is fine. I know people that have done it either way. I think you're probably going to be best off talking with some type of trust and estates lawyer, somebody who deals with the process of passing along property to heirs, and they're going to have the most knowledge of the ins and outs of the best way to do it, especially in your situation, because usually the vehicle that people go with to do that is going to depend upon the individual facts of their family dynamics.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. Bill, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Louis called, couldn't stay with us. There's recent federal legislation about real estate agents that affects their commissioning process. Kevin, are you familiar with this?
Yes, there was a large class action lawsuit that was settled, I believe, sometime in the spring. And that what that lawsuit concerned was the commissions that real estate agents charge. And the result of the lawsuit means that going forward, I believe it's starting here in the fall, real estate agents have to be more upfront with disclosing the commission that they're being charged and that they're charging. and coming to an individual agreement with their client as to what they're going to get paid out of the transaction.
Okay, so the real estate agent has to say, well, I'm going to be charging you 6% on this $300,000 house, so that's my commission will be $18,000.
Exactly, and traditionally it has always been that 6%, 3% to the seller's agent, 3% to the buyer's agent. And as a result of this lawsuit, I think that's the percentages that are being charged are more in flux. And so it's intended to be more of a negotiation, more of a discussion between a real estate agent and their client as to what's being charged and who's paying it.
And who's paying it? Yeah, for sure. Dan emailed us. Their home was built in 2021. They recently discovered a sill stone under a window is pitched toward the house instead of away from the house. This has allowed water to enter the house and caused mold. If the builder refuses to fix the issue, is there anything Dan can do on a legal standpoint?
I mean, it's possible. A lot of the statute of limitations on claims involving real estate are either around the 3-year time period or the 6-year time period. For example, a simple breach of contract claim is a 6-year statute of limitations. So, you said your house was built in 2021. So, depending upon when that was in 2021, you may or may not be past some of those 3-year statute of limitations. But I think the first thing you need to do is approach the builder and let them know of the problem and see if they're willing to make a fix or a correction and take care of this. A lot of them will. Some will say, hey, our warranty was 1 year, and there was a reason why we have a 1-year warranty, and you're outside that period, so too bad, so sad. But nevertheless, I think that's the first thing to do is approach the builder.
And it sounds like in this case the builder was approached and said no. Then what?
Well, at that point in time, it might be worth having the case evaluated by a real estate lawyer to see if there is a claim there that is worth being brought. Sometimes cases are worth being brought because the fix is going to cost a lot of money, and the terms of your contract for the construction of the house is favorable for bringing a claim, meaning it's something that the builder shouldn't have just dismissed you on, but should have taken care of. In other situations, there might be a problem, but it might be something that the fix is going to be just a few $1,000 fix and is just worth just doing the fix rather than going down a legal route.
Yeah, for sure. On this warranty business, if the builder says, "Well, I gave you a 1-year warranty, but there's a law that says they have up to 3 years," or is that warranty that you agreed to override the 3 years?
Well, that can depend. A lot of times, that'll be a point of disagreement where the builder would say, we gave you a 1-year warranty, and that you're stuck with that. However, there are a number of situations where you're not going to have your ability to take legal recourse limited by it, simply that warranty, that you actually have the full 6 years for a breach of contract.
Okay. Need to look into that for sure to make sure. Tim and Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, yes. I was just wondering, Larry, if your guest could talk about, I've heard it's really common for, people up in age to put their property into a trust, I guess, to avoid taxes, for their children. Could you talk about what that's about and why that might be a benefit? And I'll hear on the air what you have to say.
Okay. So if you, what is the benefit? You put, a lot of people put their homes in a trust for the kids to avoid taxes on the kids' end.
That's true. A lot of them do. And that would be something that probably a tax attorney would have the most knowledge of and be able to advise on. Some people's accountants might have some informed opinions on that as well. But it is a very common practice to put a house in a trust, and then, you know, have the trust is made up so that upon somebody's passing, the trustee for the trust automatically turns over to the child or children.
Yeah. And yeah, and if you look at the limits of before taxing of properties, it's a couple of $1 million, isn't it, or something? I mean,
yes, the federal government's always changing the level over which an estate is taxed. And it, I think you're right, Larry, at this point in time, it's $2 or $3 million is the threshold before the taxes kick in.
Yeah, before they kick in. So, yeah. Tim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Are there pros and cons, Kathleen wants to know, of offering to purchase, including a clause requiring binding arbitration unless otherwise deleted or omitted by the seller and buyer?
That's not something I typically see, but that is a clause you'll see in a lot of other types of contracts and a lot of other types of situations where if parties to the contract have a disagreement, the contract says you can't really just go to court and file a claim. Instead, the dispute resolution process is through arbitration, which is outside of the court process, where a private, usually an attorney, maybe a former judge, serves as the arbiter. Basically, they sit in place of the judge and make the decisions as to people's claims and arguments and to come up with a resolution to a situation.
So it may save some money?
It can save some money. The other benefit that people see to arbitration is there's nothing in the public record. In other words, in Wisconsin, you can go online and search all through the court cases in the state courts of Wisconsin and pull up any cases that involve a certain person or a certain company. And so if you have an arbitration clause, if somebody has a problem or a dispute, traditionally that could lead to a lawsuit filing, which would show up on the public record as, you know, X versus Y. But if you have an arbitration clause, then that goes to, a private arbiter to decide, and you don't have that showing up in the public record.
And so there'd be some people, that would be an advantage for some individuals, I would guess.
I would think so. Some people, or companies may not like to have, a lot of publicity out there or public availability of knowing that there have been 10, 20, 30 court cases filed involving them over the last 5 years.
Where can you find a reputable lawyer to help you out with real estate and legal issues?
Generally, if a lot of people ask around and get recommendations from friends, absent that, the State Bar of Wisconsin, which is the kind of the governing body for lawyers in the state, if you look them up on the internet, there's called a lawyer referral hotline where there's a number you call and it's staffed by somebody from the state bar, and they will listen to your description of the problem, and they have a list of people who have signed up to be a part of the state lawyer hotline or the state bar referral service, and the folks at the state bar can give you the name and number of somebody in the area of expertise that you're describing that can potentially handle your problem.
Yeah. Interesting. And a good way to end. Kevin, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much. Kevin Trost, the founding attorney of Trost LLC in Madison. As you could hear, he has extensive experience handling these kinds of disputes regarding buying or selling a home. Coming up, if you're going to sell a home or you're thinking about it down the road, we'll be giving you some advice on getting it ready to sell. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in to WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to spend the next 25 minutes or so talking about getting your home ready to sell and how a professional home stager can help you out. Molly Marino is with us today. She's a home stager and designing broker, also a realtor, and she's based out of Chicago, and great to have her with us to talk about preparing your home to hit the market. Have you worked with a professional stager before? What was the experience like? Want to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Molly Marino, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Of course. Hi, Larry.
So,
glad to be here.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, how do you get a home ready for sale as a professional home stager?
Well, I think there's a couple ways to look at getting your home ready. There's what everybody should do at a very basic level, right? This is often your biggest investment. You want to make the most return on your investment when you sell. So whether or not you use a professional stager or just are getting it ready yourself, I think there's a whole list of things to take into account. At a very basic level, I think you listen to your realtor when you go on the market and you say, hey, what's the buyer going to say when they come through here? Are there any pain points or glaring issues with my home that you think I should address? And don't be offended if somebody says, oh, that you can't be. You know, as a seller, you can't be offended. You just have to take the expert's, you know, advice. And they may come in and say, hey, you know, that bright red wall isn't going to play very well when you go to sell it. I think you should paint it. It's okay. We all still might love bright red walls, but if it's going to help you sell by painting the wall beige or white, then just do it. You got to kind of divorce yourself from the emotions you have with your home and think about how to make a nice clean slate for the next buyer. So when I look at staging, I look at all of the things, from how does the furniture lay out to are the carpets clean? Have the windows been cleaned? Are there any paint colors that maybe buyers are going to have issues with? Is there an outdated light fixture when you walk in the door that it's the first thing you see? And would it be pretty easy to replace that for not much money? So it's kind of taking a step back, looking at your home from somebody else's eyes, and not being offended to make some changes, knowing it might not be what you would do in your own home, but keeping in mind it's not going to be your home anymore. Pretty soon it's going to be somebody else's, and that's the point.
That is the point. I used a professional home stager for a lake home that I had and sold, and it was quite a nice experience, a good learning experience. You're right. There were some things she said about the home that I thought, the furniture, I think, some of the furniture.
Now I want to see your furniture, Larry.
But in the end, you know, for that one, she even did a nice video from the lake in the house, looking out onto the lake and the Monona Terrace and so forth. I wish I'd hung on to that video because it would have been a nice remembrance of the home. But I found it really did help a lot. How'd you get into this business?
Well, I've been a realtor for about 15 years, and I've always had an interest in making homes beautiful. It's just kind of what I, you know, in my own home, I do that too. And so as I started to work with clients selling in real estate, I would go into some homes and realize, oh boy, you know, we need help in here. And I would start doing it for my clients. I'd say, you know, let me spend a few hours putting some things away and pulling tchotchkes off shelves and fluffing pillows and making beds. It kind of started very gently like that. And then about, I don't know, 9 years or so ago, I had a client who lived out of state and had an investment property here in Chicago, and they wanted me to sell it. And it was vacant and had been a rental for a couple of years prior to that. So the walls were kind of dark and dirty, and it didn't have a lot of luster. And I said to them, you know, if I can put furniture in here and paint these walls, you're going to make a lot more money. And the investment you're going to put into that is, you know, maybe a couple $1,000s, but it's going to net you, you know, at least 50 or 60 on the back end. And so they trusted me to do it. And I thought, instead of hiring a stager at the time, I was like, I know what I'm doing. I used the money they gave me to start my staging company. It was just a little nest egg. And I bought the basics of the furniture and invested in other things myself. And I, the condo, absolutely beautiful. I did the before pictures and the after pictures, and it sold immediately. And it kind of snowballed from there, because then a lot of home staging companies are actually just home stagers. I'm actually a realtor too. So people started to hear about, oh, there's a realtor that does home staging. I can kind of get both things in one. And so the past 8 years have just taken on this crazy momentum, which is really fun for me.
What are the details that sellers will pay attention to when they come to your house? Example, will they take how your home smells into account?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I speak as a realtor, too. When you think about that, when you step into a home, you have a one chance to make a first impression. And if you walk through the door and you walk into a bright space where all the blinds are open and the lights are on and everything is tidy, you immediately say, this has potential, versus walking into a home where the blinds are shut, there's a stain on the carpet, light bulbs are out in the light fixtures. All of that tells you a little bit about how well the home has been maintained over time. So that first impression is so important. And it doesn't cost a lot of money as a seller to do that. You know, I say simple things like have your carpets cleaned before you go on the market. Spend a day cleaning the insides and the outsides of your windows. It amazes me sometimes when I walk into a place and realize, oh my gosh, those windows haven't been cleaned in years, and there's, you know, a layer of muck on the outside. it's little things. You know, make the bed and make it look pretty. You know, when you walk into a hotel room and see a nicely made bed and think, oh, I just want to sink into that, try as best you can to make your bed look like that, so when somebody comes to the home, they can see themselves relaxing in that space.
I'm wondering about curb appeal. You know, the house I have now, I have a nice house, but if I was going to sell it, and I'm not, but if I was going to sell it, I would put it up in the middle of July, because in the middle of July, the front of my house is just alive with flowers. Mm-hmm. And the outside appeal is definitely the best it's ever going to look all year in those, say, about the 10th to the 20th of July.
Yes. Yes.
Is that a wise move? I mean, curb appeal is what I was thinking about, and I'm sure curb appeal is important.
Well, of course it is. I mean, that's somebody's first, their first impression of the property, right? So whether you have a single family home or even live in a condo building, when you walk up to that building, and for instance, if it's a condo and you walk into the foyer and it hasn't been swept in a while, somebody says, ugh, you know? So yes, that's all very important. And of course, having a nice clean, you know, even if you're not a green thumb and can't keep things alive in your yard, you know, go to the local hardware store and buy a really nice potted plant right before you go on the market and keep watering that thing until your house does, you know, really make it look nice. You know, and there is a trick, Larry, because I know not everybody has the luxury of selling in the peak summer months and getting their house ready when the yards look vibrant. But if you're thinking of selling within, you know, the next 8 to 10 months and you're not quite sure, reach out to your agent and say, hey, I know I'm going to have to list my house in February, but the outside looks fantastic in July. I often will pre-shoot photos, exterior photos, for my clients in the summer, knowing that they're going to be listing in the winter. I just take that one step and say, let's bring the photographer out, capture all those pictures so that when we list in February, I'm not trying to shoot photos with, you know, potentially snow on the ground and, you know, dirty melt everywhere. And it's just thinking ahead, and your partner agent should be more than happy to do that for you.
Yeah. What kinds of small renovation projects have the best return on investment?
Ooh, I love this question. I'm so glad you asked it. You know, in today's marketplace, there's a handful that stick out to me. And when I say them to people, they panic sometimes thinking, oh my gosh, it's going to be expensive. And I said, no, it's not. So the number one project right now for me is painting old cabinets. We are in this weird stage where a lot of construction happened in the 90s and early 2000s, and the style from then is definitely not the style now, you know, kind of dark cherry cabinets or kind of this dark wood. And you got to find the right person that can do the painting. But I will tell you, by lightening up cabinetry and giving it a fresh coat, that pays out, in my mind, about 4 to 1 in terms of the investment. You can do it the wrong way, too. You don't want to have an inexperienced painter just slap some paint on your cabinets. You want a good painter to sand them and do it properly. But it's much cheaper than redoing a whole kitchen or bathroom by just putting a fresh coat of proper paint and maybe new knobs on there. It always pays out. I've never not seen that pay out. Another project is exposing old hardwood floors. Even if you don't have the money to refinish the floors, if they're covered in carpet, buyers always like to see wood under carpet. So it's really nice to just pull that carpet up and say, you know, we can't finish them before we close, but maybe we'll give you a credit at closing. Or, hey, these beautiful oak floors will be yours to do what you would like to do with someday. So that's another one. And I think the other two that aren't very expensive but have a big impact is just swapping out a few light fixtures. If you have a very dated chandelier, or if your bathroom vanity light is one of those old Hollywood lights, you know, with those big round bulbs on it that were very much of the 80s, it costs about, you know, $100 for a new fixture, and let's say at the most maybe $100 for an electrician to install it, and it makes such a big difference. So if you can find a couple key areas that could use a little punch, a little modern punch, those things aren't as expensive as people think they are and certainly pay off. And then the last one that I would say is if you've got old tile in a bathroom, if you've got an old porcelain tub and tile that looks kind of worn and dated, I often think glazing the tub and the tile with a nice fresh coat of white glaze with a nice silicone rim really goes a long way to cleaning up a bathroom. Mm-hmm. And that's usually a couple $100 investment as well.
Yeah, so, and it's sounding like the kitchen, the bathroom, maybe the living room. I mean, the key areas.
Yeah.
Or are there key, or am I not right there?
Oh, no. Kitchens and baths are always what sell homes. And then your first impression spaces, your foyer and your living room. You know, when you walk in to the space where you would spend most of your time, it's the kitchen, it's the living room. Make sure your bedroom looks welcoming, but usually you don't have to do a ton of work in a bedroom. And make sure your bathrooms don't look so dated that the buyer says, oh, I'm going to have to gut this thing from top to bottom. Because when they think that, immediately in their mind, they think, oh, that's going to cost me $30,000. But if they walk into a bathroom and it's acceptable, clean and acceptable, immediately that future investment is kind of not top of mind for them. Same with the kitchen. If I walk into a kitchen and think, I'm going to have to gut this kitchen, it's going to cost me $50,000 versus, oh, these cabinets are nice. I might just want to, you know, change out the faucet or maybe change out the counters. That's not going to cost me so much. It's much easier for a buyer to swallow that than a whole renovation.
Yeah. Jeff wonders, is it ethical when staging to ask messy neighbors to clean up their yard or keep the barking dogs inside during a showing?
You know, I think that's a really good question. And I think it behooves you as a seller to say, hey, I'm about to go on the market. It means a lot to me to show my property well. Would you mind doing these things? I mean, you can't force somebody to do that. And I think as a good neighbor, if somebody had asked me to make a correction, I would want to do that because ultimately my equity is their equity. If my house or my condo sells for a fair amount of money, then it's immediately elevating your property value too. So I don't see any reason not to ask for something like that. It's a neighborly thing to do.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. If you have something unique at your home, like maybe it's a pool or an indoor hot tub, or maybe it's an outdoor basketball court in the backyard, do you recommend sellers lean into those items or remove them to make the home more universally appealing, shall we say?
Well, and I would say on that one, this is where I'd say refer to your agent who knows the area best. You know, there's kind of as a home stager, and if I kind of take the agency part out of it and say, if I'm just a home stager, I work with an agent to say, what is your goal for selling this property? Who's your target buyer? If your target buyer is a family and there's a swimming pool, then as a home stager, I would say, I'm going to make that pool look as fantastic as I can. I'm going to roll up towels on those chairs and put a beach ball in the water and do all the things that make that pool seem like my dream pool. If the agent says to me, oh, this home has a pool, but our target buyer is a, you know, likely a single guy in his 20s that's not going to want a pool upkeep. And I'll say, well, what about this property would speak to them? And they might say, oh, hey, it's the basement because you can have a pool table down there, a billiards room. Well, then, you know, you kind of really focus on who that target buyer is and play to what they would want to see. And I think that's a smart way to think about it.
Yeah, I would agree. Vivian in Green Bay has a comment or question. Vivian, hi.
My comment is timing for your improvements. From the day I moved in here 20 years ago, I've been working on the envelope of the house, which included sill box insulation, attic insulation, new windows, new doors. But the interior, I'm not touching that really until I get closer to sell because I do have some pets, a couple of dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I'm putting my money slowly in to the envelope projects. I'll do the interior closer to sale date.
Vivian, I think that's a really smart thing to do as well, because think about how quickly design trends change. You know, what you would put in, say, 2 years ago, everybody was putting in those gray cabinets, and now everybody is kind of swinging back toward white cabinets again, or maybe a sage green. Things change so quickly, but all those major components of your home, the insulation, the roof, the windows, that doesn't go out of style ever, right? So I think you're doing it the absolute right way.
Yeah, absolutely. Vivian, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. What about photos? We had a lot of photos taken of our home to put up, but what should you think about when taking photos of your home for sale to post online? Which kinds of pictures perform the best? And I'm assuming a home stager, I know you, I've seen your photos on your own page, and they're very striking. But can a home stager help out with those photos? I assume they can.
Well, absolutely. So I'm not going to take credit for those photos, Larry. I am going to credit my professional partner. So I know my skill. My skill is to have a good eye to see a space and to design that space. And I can take a good photo on my iPhone, but I certainly am not a professional photographer. So I think it's important as a real estate agent and as a stager to invest in a professional photographer when you're selling your home. And most agents, at least in my neck of the woods here in Chicago in the suburbs, will provide professional photography as part of the listing package. I would never do it any other way because everything sells online. As you know, these days, everybody's on Zillow and Redfin and downloading apps to look at homes. And so what draws you in, it's that first photo you see of the exterior of the home that makes you want to click. So if I get one chance to make that first impression, I want that photo to be picture perfect. And while my iPhone photo might be nice, I certainly tell you, my photographer that comes in with a Nikon with a nice lens is going to nail it much better than I will. So that small investment of a couple $100 is worth thousands and thousands in the sale of the home to me on the back end.
Hmm. You might hear the advice that it's best to have a lot of natural light in your home, and you mentioned that kind of in passing. And the pictures, what about the pictures you have in your home?
You mean like personal photos?
Yeah, personal or other.
Yeah, so I think it's important when you walk through a home, you want to depersonalize the space a little bit, right? So I always tell people, take down your family photos, take down anything that has a lot of emotional value or even religious value, because you just want a blank slate for somebody to kind of look at the structure of the home and the room sizes. You don't want them to get hung up on your things, right? And I will tell you, there are times where I walk into a home and somebody will have something. Maybe it's a vintage piece of furniture or a piece of artwork that is just so memorable. It can kind of work for or against you. If it's something you like, you walk away saying, oh my gosh, that was that house with that really cool piece of art. If it's something you don't like, like, you walk away saying, oh, that weird house. You remember that weird room? So I think, you know, it's important to kind of make it a little, you know, tone it down a little bit, remove the personal items from the home, but also you don't want it to have no personality, right? So you can leave a little bit of it. And I always say, look for that second opinion. Ask your agent, ask a home stager, you know, what can I do? And I think there's another way to look at this too. People bring me in, Larry, two ways. Sometimes they bring me in and say, my home is vacant or will be vacant. Will you bring in all the furniture and make it look beautiful like a designer lives here? And of course I say, yes, I would love to do that. I also have sellers call me and say, can I just pay you to come in for a day, work with what I have in my home and rearrange things and maybe rehang artwork and give me a plan for the 10 things I need to do to get this ready. And those are really fun. It's affordable for a seller. I will come in and work with them. I bring my hammer and nails. I bring my, you know, my measuring tape, and I start moving things around and helping them put things in closets. And then we find the holes. We'll say, wait, this wall's missing something. This is what you need to add. I often go online and we'll find something on Amazon or on, you know, Home Goods, and I'll say, go buy this. This is going to look perfect right on that wall, that piece of art. And it's a really simple way of having a second opinion to just give you another check on your design before you go on the market.
Do you recommend using paint colors that reflect the era of the house, or make everything neutral and kind of boring?
Well, that's a little, it's hard to weigh that because, you know, I live in a vintage bungalow in Chicago and my house is 115 years old. So there is a part of me that says, well, of course you want to stay true to the bones of the house and its history. I think there's a nice marriage between that as well as keeping a home light and bright, or even perhaps impactful. Maybe it is a navy blue kitchen that's going to, you know, catch somebody's eye. But I think the idea there is, neutral is good. I think when you think about home sales, if you walk into a room that's bright orange, bright red, bright yellow, people tend to, you know. But if you walk in a room that's beige or maybe a neutral, like a slate blue or something, those aren't as egregious in my opinion. So, you know, within reason, keep it toned down within reason.
And how do we find a professional home stager who will work well with you in your home?
Well, there's a couple of national organizations for home stagers. I'm a member of the Real Estate Staging Association, which is one of them. But I will say probably the quickest way to find a good stager is, if you're working with a realtor, to ask them who their preferred stager is. They will give you recommendations. You can always come to my website, mollymarino.com. I'm happy to make referrals to stagers. I'm connected with stagers around the country through this national network that I'm in. And also, you know, we can't rule out Yelp or Google, looking at reviews and, frankly, looking at people's portfolios. When you come to my website, you will see hundreds of before and after pictures of how I've taken a space from one thing to another, and in various ways. Sometimes a home might be more traditional, and I can't force fit a super modern design in there, but I can certainly elevate the look. You want somebody that has the flexibility to work with the bones of the home and make sure that the furnishings and the design look appropriate for the sale.
Molly, great, and I loved your website, mollymarino.com. The photos are very captivating, and thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Molly Marino, and her site, mollymarino.com. Coming up, we're going to take a look at renters and renters' rights. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at renters and renters' rights on the program. Renters face many challenges in navigating their housing situations, but Wisconsin residents have places like the Tenant Resource Center on their side. And today we're going to be talking with two Tenant Resource Center employees, and we'll be talking about resources for renters, cover dealing with eviction notices, seeking repairs, understanding leases, and a whole lot more with our two guests. One of them, Chris Belli Antimo, is an associate director of the Tenant Resource Center. Chris Belli, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Great to have you with us today. Also with us today, Kayana Amaguano Cachequango, who is the Eviction Diversion and Defense Partnership Program Manager. That's a mouthful, by the way, Kayana. But she's the program manager at the Tenant Resource Center. And Kayana, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate having you both with us. And as you listen to our two experts, I hope you'll join in. Are you a renter? What's your advice for having a smooth relationship with your landlord? Give us your questions about maybe the eviction process or how to break a lease early. Join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Let's start. Tell us a little bit about the Tenant Resource Center. How do you help renters and landlords in Wisconsin?
Hi, Larry. Yeah, I can give you a little bit of our background and information, just general services that TRC is able to provide. So we have been around for about 45 years now. Well, next year it will be our 45th anniversary. And then we have three specific programs, one of which is the housing counseling program that consists of staff that help tenants and landlords answer any questions in regards to tenant-landlord law. So we are very focused on the 704 chapter, legislators chapter 704. And we are also very well informed about the ATCP 134, which are the laws that cover the tenant landlord living experience regulations. So our housing counselors can help anyone just walk-ins with information or questions, from repairs to security deposits to understanding your lease. We can guide you also in how to reply to a landlord if you have a 5-day, 14-day, 30-day notice. If this is your first time renting and you need the ins and outs, we're able to give you that information as a housing counselor. And that's what we like to let the community know. We aren't attorneys, so we cannot give you legal advice or tell you what to do, but we will help you understand what the processes look like and what your options are. And at the end of the day, it is every person's own decision, deciding what it is they want to do and how they want to move forward. Because not everyone lives the same way or has the same family members or whatnot. So a decision that I make might not be the same decision you would make.
Where are your offices located, by the way?
Yeah, so our main office is 2510 Winnebago Street. We just recently moved here, and we are open 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday to Thursday. We have a hybrid, we have another satellite office in Sun Prairie, which is Sunshine. And we are available there Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays from 8:30 to 5 p.m. And then we also staff Goodman South Campus on Perry Street. And we are there Saturday mornings from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m.
So how'd you get involved in this kind of work, by the way? I'll ask you both that. Go ahead, Chris Belli.
Yeah, thanks. So I heard about it and I had nothing, no background in housing. I think it was more of a lived experience type of thing. I got very involved because of all the misleading information that our community of Spanish speakers have. So knowing what we thought was okay and normal through my childhood, later on finding out it's not okay. So after learning all this information and these laws and regulations, I decided it was a good opportunity for me to become involved and to also share this knowledge with the community.
And Kayana, what about you?
Yeah, so for me, I got involved during the pandemic. During the pandemic, as you're aware that there was a lot of just people that fell behind on rent, and with different funding that came available through different federal funds and the government and everything, there was some rental assistance available. And I was working for a different different organization at that time, and they needed assistance. The Tenant Resource Center needed assistance with distributing those rental assistance funds to the, specifically the Spanish-speaking community, because the funds were out there, but specifically the Spanish-speaking community just wasn't applying. So that's how I heard about the Tenant Resource Center. I applied eventually to here, and then I've been here ever since. So it's about almost 3 years now. And one program that Chris Belli mentioned was the housing counseling program. But another big program that we have at the Tenant Resource Center focuses a lot about the eviction process and the tenants facing eviction in Dane County. So what my program, the EDDP program, or the Eviction Diversion Defense Partnership. So it's a mouthful. We do outreach to all the tenants that are facing eviction in Dane County. So we try to educate them about the process, try to provide some rental assistance funds, and most importantly, try to connect them with attorneys that can represent them in eviction court. So a lot of landlords are represented and they know the process very well, but a lot of tenants just don't know what their rights are going through the eviction process. Sometimes they get those court papers, they don't know what they mean, they don't know why they got those court papers, and they're a little bit lost, and my program kind of helps them navigate that process.
We have, somebody's wondering, what resources are there for renters and landlords outside of your area where you work, in Madison area? Chris Belli.
Yeah, so at the moment, we are not well informed of what other resources there is out there outside of Dane County. But as we speak, we do have one of our staff members who is currently looking for that information so that we can have it on our website. But it will take time just to make sure that most of these services are still open. As we found out, most of the services that were available did close during the pandemic. So it's a lot of investigating, making sure things are still open and running. But Kayana can share a little bit about like eviction process.
We know the eviction process in Dane County very well, but there are similar steps that are taken in other counties. So if there's general questions about a specific notice or anything like that, we can potentially answer those questions. But if someone is looking for legal assistance or legal representation in outside of Dane County, there are other organizations. One organization that does pop in my head is Legal Action of Wisconsin. They do have offices, I know, in like Green Bay and Milwaukee area and stuff like that. So that they would be a good resource if someone has more legal questions.
And we work closely with
them. Yeah.
Nina in Menasha has a question or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Nina.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. With the crisis in actually our whole country, but Wisconsin, the rent is getting ridiculous. I'm a renter, I'll be all my life. But I was surprised to find out about more people need to press our Congress or our local officials to get a rent control in Wisconsin. I found out if you go on lawdistrict.com, you can see an actual map. I found this out because a friend of mine does flipping. He flips houses. And he told me that there are companies and people with money from out of state swarming to Wisconsin and buying up properties to, because they can up the rent as much as they want. And to prove it, my brother got $300 a month a couple months ago. And they said, yep, we're upping the rent $300 more a month. And he'd lived there for 6 years. Of course, there's, costs, but he either could move or pay it. And why isn't more protection done in Wisconsin having a rent control to stop this from happening? This is ridiculous.
That is a good question and something that we have been noticing, too. We do have a lot of data on just the leases that we get and then the renewals. People that we've worked with have noticed that increase of rent very rapidly, suddenly. I talk to tenants every day, and that's one of their main concerns. One of the things that we all always get asked here is like, is there any way to like protect yourself from those rent increase or anything like that? And unfortunately, a lot of that power is with just the laws of the state. So if your lease ends, your landlord is entitled to raise the rent by any amount. There is no cap in how much they raise that rent. But that means that's when the lease ends. So for example, they can't change your rent at the middle of any lease agreement. If you are some sort of month-to-month tenant, they have to give you a proper notification before increasing your rent. If you are a month-to-month tenant, that means giving you 28-day notice and stuff like that. So there is no rent control, but there are certain things in place that can protect you while you're in your tenancy or during your lease.
Thank you very much for calling, Nina. Appreciate it. We had an email from Josh who had a comment about raising the rent too, but also mentioned to the landlord, his landlord, that certain things need to be fixed or replaced, and they're not doing it. So an example Josh has is the windows that leak cold air during the winter. And all Josh did was take the window trim off and re-insulate them. But how can landlords get away with this is what his question is, not fixing or taking care of the property itself.
Yeah, so in those types of scenarios, it does depend where you live in the county, let's say. What we have seen here a lot in Madison is that there is a thing called rent abatement. We do encourage tenants to reach out to your landlord in writing, letting them know of the situation so that it gets repaired. I know that depending on what the repair is, you can only wait so long, right? So there is the next step, which would be filing a complaint with DATCAP, letting them know like, hey, my landlord is not repairing this and I'm going through these conditions. And then DATCAP would give you some feedback on that. Another option is to file a report or call the building inspector, and the building inspector will come out to your unit, inspect the situation, and give the landlord a couple of days, depending again on what the repair is, so that they can get that fixed. If for some reason the landlord is not able to fix that on that during that time frame, the building inspector can, again, this is in Madison, can decide to rent abate you, and then you, the tenant, would be eligible for rent abatement, which means reducing some of the rent payment because of that repairs not being done.
Typically, and you must deal with this a lot, what are things that you might be responsible when it comes to repairs, you know, typically, and what would the landlord be responsible for? Is there a typical comment on that, Chris Belli?
Yeah, so usually the simple things like light bulbs and making sure you're upkeeping with the unit. But regardless if anything breaks, you should always let your landlord know so that they can fix it. If you're not able to fix it, the landlord should fix it, but they are entitled to invoice you for that. So whether it's your fault, whether it's not your fault. Yeah, anything you want to add to that?
No, just going back a little bit on that specific question about letting the cold, like insulating a place. There is some general, I'm not sure if it's in the whole state of Wisconsin, but in Dane County, you're in winter, your main areas like your living room, your kitchen, your bedroom should maintain 67, mm-hmm. I believe, 67 degrees Fahrenheit. And if it doesn't, that is grounds to like call the building inspector right away, because there is a law in Wisconsin that says it has to be 67 degrees inside of your house. And if it isn't, that is a violation that the landlord is committing.
Talking about renters and renters' rights with our guest today, Kiana Amaguana, Kechiguango, and our other guest, Chris Belli Antimo, who are with the Tenant Resource Center. Join in with your questions. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today about renters and renters' rights with Kiana and Chris Belli from the Tenant Resource Center, operating out of Madison and Dane County. Great to have them with us. And let's take a call from Rona in Cameron. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hello to your guests. I'm so excited to be able to pose this question today. So my son has lived in Eau Claire in the same place for 8 years. It's been sold 4 different times. Each time, I mean, because he's lived there for a number of years now, there have been things that have been needed to be repaired. So he'll contact the current owner about getting something repaired. It doesn't happen. Then the place gets sold, and the repair still hasn't occurred. And this has been going on for years now. Now my son is looking at moving out, and we just don't really know what to do.
So in terms of he's moving because these changes haven't been made, and he's wondering how could that be remedied or what should he do next in terms of finding another place?
Well, when he moves out, all these things that have never been fixed because of the changes are going to be off his security deposit, and it's going to end up costing probably more than a security deposit. Like, for example, someone tried to break into his apartment, so one of the screens is really ripped. Someone another time tried to break in, and the door jamb is busted. And this is just, it's just never been repaired, and I worry about how much he'll lose.
Hmm. What do you think, Kiana?
Yeah. After listening to that, that one of the main things that we always ask a tenant is, do you have any written documentation of you requesting these repairs, whether it's the first landlord, second landlord, third landlord, from whenever you moved in? And that's why also the check-ins, pictures, and writing it down, it's very important. So if your son has any of that information, I would highly suggest that they continue to ask for these repairs and to just send anything, old documents that he has, to the current landlord, and even reaching out to the building inspector at this point in time. So those would be my suggestions for now for your son. But if he, like you said, he's been living there for a couple of years now, look back through his email, text messages, pictures that he might have that can demonstrate that the issues have been ongoing for the past couple of years.
Yeah. And the other part that I'll add is that I know there was some concern about like the deductions from the security deposit. Whenever a landlord removes anything or deducts anything from a security deposit, you're entitled to know why they did that. So you can always ask for like an invoice or an itemized list of the different deductions that they took. And you can write a letter contesting those charges. Like if you don't agree with them, like for this case, it could be, I've asked for this to be repaired multiple times. Here's the proof. Please remove this from the deduction of my security deposit. So on our website, we also have templates on how to ask for these security deposit deductions to be removed. So that could be a good resource too for this person.
So tenant, what's your website?
Tenantresourcecenter.org.
Tenantresourcecenter.org. Rona, there you go. Thank you for calling. Patricia in Edigo, your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I'm an attorney, and I live in northern Wisconsin, and I worked for the last 5 years at Judicare Legal Aid, which is the legal aid services for northern 33 counties and the 11 tribal nations of Wisconsin. So if people have tenant questions in northern Wisconsin, Judicare is the place they should call. Legal Action serves the southern part of the state and the east coast, basically. But I would reiterate, if you've got issues with repairs, make sure that you document your request for repairs and call the building inspector or sometimes it's the county that does building inspectors in the more rural areas before you withhold any rent, because you can get evicted for withholding rent. And Madison, I lived in Madison for 50 years, but Madison has a rent abatement ordinance. Wausau also has a rent abatement ordinance. but outside of Madison and Wausau, there's really no specific procedure for abating rent. And you don't want to self-help abate. You want to make sure that you have notified the landlord, you've made it clear what needs to be fixed, and there are certain violations that would make your place uninhabitable, like no heat, for instance, yeah. or no electricity. There's a state code. So make sure you document all that. With regard to rent control, there were changes to the laws in 2011 that were very disadvantageous to tenants. And one was restricting the ability of local governments to have rent control or rent abatement programs. So it's the state legislature that would need to do something about that.
Hmm. Patricia, a lot of good information there. Thank you so much for calling. And I see our guests today have been smiling or nodding in agreement as you talk. Thank you very much for calling. And Mary in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Hello. I was wondering if I could, I don't have internet at home, but if I could go to the library, if I were to move and I thought this place was nice, is there a website that the city of Madison has where you can check on landlords for complaints and fines they've paid?
All right, Chris Belly or Kiana, do you know of a place that Mary could go to check on that?
Did Mary, did you say complaints?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Not that I know of. There is not a website with complaints, but if there is a unit or a property that you're interested in, you can always, before you get more information, is request the... you can always call the building inspector to get some information about inspections, and even DATCAP, they can give you information about what has been reported from other tenants. And if you were to decide to sign a lease, when you get that to the unit, you can always ask a copy for the itemized list from the reductions from the previous tenant security deposit as well.
Hmm. And Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection does have a list of complaints, you know, people who have complained about a specific property. So,
yep.
Yeah, there you go, Mary. Thank you. Appreciate it. And Brian and Madison, quick comment?
Oh, yes. Hi. Good afternoon. I have a question. This has come up before with the pressure on apartments in Madison that there's a lot of competition for fewer units. And I wanted to ask or get clarification. So the landlord can choose to not renew a tenant. Isn't that correct? Within that context, How much do you really want to complain about a leaking faucet or whatever? So I'll let you take it from there.
Yeah, thank you. So the landlord has the ability to non-renew your lease. Is that correct?
For the most part, yes. So a landlord can non-renew your lease and doesn't have to disclose the reason why. Now, there is a couple of asterisks to that. One of them is that if you do live in some sort of subsidized housing, like Section 8, Section 42, they do need to give you the reason, and the reason has to be a valid reason. That term valid reason, that can be interpreted kind of in different ways. And then the other one is that if you believe that your landlord non-renew you because of some sort of discrimination reason, specifically in the city of Madison, just because there's a lot of different protected classes in the city of Madison, that might be a reason to potentially get some legal advice and some like legal representation, just because proving that something is discrimination is its own battle.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. But you have on your site information for people who can, you know, respond to a number of the situations we've talked about today. And again, the site is
It is tenantresourcecenter.org.
Tenantresourcecenter.org. Kiana, Chris Belly, thank you both so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, and hopefully we can do this again down the road. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting us. Take care.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening in today. Tomorrow's Garden Talk, of course, and this show, Garden Talk, all the shows are a team effort. Big thanks to our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.